Ah, yes, it's that time again. Sit down, control the belches. But do keep a smile on your face, because an older Bean is here with another instalment of The Good Life. Actually, we're picking up part two of a program which Noel began long before Australia entered the dark days of the Ashes cricket series. Noel, good to have you back.
Good to be back, John.
Now, we were talking about Mormons a few weeks ago.
Back on July 24th, actually. That's how long ago.
It was the last program it was it? July 24th, and it was about the Great Trek and the origin of Joseph Smith and how they sort of moved out of Nauvoo and off on the trek led by Brigham Young.
Exactly, with the big pioneer movement, which is part of the real sort of sense of story that Mormons have about, that the Latter-day Saints tell about themselves, which of course you've seen in film, but it's about being persecuted in the east of America and making that huge trek across, and Pioneer Day
into
was the day.
Into the open frontier. Yep.
And last time, you know, way back before the cricket and before England retained the Ashes, I'm told, is the correct way to put it, that back in that day we started out setting up what this was all about, where that sort of idea or that sense of identity that Latter-day Saints have about themselves as a people who trekked and, you know, re-established a new land, a new Zion is the word they use.
Exodus, I think, is where it's found.
I think that might be it, actually. I think you're absolutely right there. But it is a sort of a fascinating, pioneering, cowboy-y sort of story, I've got to say. Very American, because it's one of those new faiths, a modern faith. They won't say that, of course. It's a restored faith. But if you look at it sociologically, it emerges in the 19th century. There it is, in America, in a new land, as it were. And where we were last time we were doing this was with Bruce Lindsay, who's the mission president from Perth, who himself was a broadcaster, who's reported quite often on Pioneer Day celebrations, which is a very big deal in Utah. And Bruce was setting up for us some of that context. And what we're going to talk about in this episode is the actual process itself, the journey, how it was triggered, and what they're up to. But here's a little sound from that, of course, big Pioneer Day celebration.
I don't know about you, but I want to see that jet fly by again. That was neat. Big Pioneer Day. Salt Lake City Chief of Police Chris Burbank with us today. The days of 47 parades. Coming up shortly will be the Utah Pipe Man.
Perth Mission President Bruce Lindsay, welcome to the program and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Noel.
Can I begin with the difficulties that faced those very early Latter-day Saints, where they're emerging within a highly religious American culture, a new restored faith, as Joseph Smith would have said, has been established, and there is great resentment that this community of Latter-day Saints has a great deal of solidarity and cooperation and therefore looks like a threat to outsiders. And in fact, Joseph Smith himself is murdered by a mob.
That's true. In 1844, he surrendered and voluntarily went to face charges in Carthage, Illinois, not far from Nauvoo. And as he was there in protective custody, a mob came, broke into the jail, assassinated him and his brother.
So we're talking about serious violence. And then I read also of other difficulties there, described in different ways depending on which narrative of history you accept, but there's something called the Gallatin Election Battle, there's something called the Hounds Hill Massacre, there are all sorts of events which are described where Latter-day Saints are being killed, and we're talking about scores of people who are being shot dead.
Yeah, Hounds Mill in particular, that was part of the extermination from western Missouri, and women and children were fired upon and killed indiscriminately, and it was a very sorry chapter in American history. You've seen the old westerns of American violence,
in
the absence of justice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was part of that. And so the Latter-day Saints were forced to flee.
This all ends up, after 17 years, their leader's been shot dead, he's been assassinated, murdered, and we get to 1847. What has the leadership of that early church decided by 1847?
Those who opposed Joseph Smith, who took his life, assumed that that would be the end of the Mormon movement, that they would be scattered and dissolved. But that did not prove to be the case. The church is organized with the foundation of apostles after the original Christian church, which we profess to be. And the leader of the apostles, the senior apostle, was a man named Brigham Young, who was a very strong and determined leader and an incredible organizer. And prior to Joseph Smith's death, he had spoken openly that the only place that the Latter-day Saints would find refuge would be in the Rocky Mountains, which was at that time not even part of the United States. It was part of Mexican territory.
He'd scoped this out somewhere. How did he know that?
He studied it and made a brilliant calculation. Latter-day Saints believe that he received that from God, mm-hmm. that was the destiny for his people, at least the next phase for his people. And so the Latter-day Saints continued building homes, finishing their temple in Nauvoo, 1844, 45. Things got very, very, very difficult. 46, there was an exodus across the frozen Mississippi River. And during the winter of 1846, 1847, thousands and thousands of Latter-day Saints were camped on the Missouri River, the other side of Iowa, waiting for the spring thaw to carry out their journey overland. It was about 2,100 kilometers, I think, is the distance. What set this journey apart from the others, Noel, is that the Oregon Trail had just opened up, and there were all sorts of persons seeking their fortune and wealth who got a wagon or outfitted themselves. But the Mormons went in organized companies down to the supervisors of the hundreds, the tens, the 50s.
This is the deliberate organization of effectively an exodus and an organized exodus of the entire people.
That's right. And it took a number of years, but I think about 2,500 made that trek the first year, followed, as you say, in the next two decades by upwards of 70,000 before the railroad crossed the continent. And they all did that in church-organized companies of people who were there with their ecclesiastical leaders as well as their secular leaders, and not only organized their provisions, but organized their spiritual welfare. Stopped on the Sabbath, did not travel, stopped for prayer, organized schools for the children as they crossed the continent. Most interestingly, they planted crops and moved on, that crops would be harvested by the others who would come following them. It was all calculated to help their fellow men.
So that first April 5th, 1847, 143 set out to go and find, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly.
You're right. 143 men, I think 3 women and 2 children.
And I think 3 black slaves who were freed.
Yes, 3 African Americans who were members of the church who came. They left as early as they could in April, and they got there late in July in the heat, the scorching heat of July, and there are about 2 more good months to make that trek, and then you get into October and you're crossing the Rocky Mountains as the snows start to fly. So there were others lined up behind them all the way across the plains. Brigham Young, interestingly, a couple of weeks later, got on a horse, turned around, rode back to winter quarters, and spent the winter there organizing and bringing, you know, the next wave for the next year. And then he returned to the Great Basin, the Rocky Mountains, and lived for another nearly 30 years and never left.
As I recall the story, Brigham Young himself was ill when he arrived. He was in the sickness carriages because I believe they got ticks or something.
Ticks. They're calling it mountain fever, which we believe was caused by ticks. Rocky Mountain spotted fever is what it's called today. And indeed, the Vanguard Company arrived in the Salt Lake Valley on the 21st of July. Brigham Young was the last to arrive because he had been ill and had been delayed. The oft-quoted statement that he made, "This is the right place, drive on," that has been immortalized in monuments and in parades, that Brigham Young indeed said that. But he knew exactly where they were going.
What did they find? Can you take us back to that point where they look at the site of what is now Salt Lake City? What were they looking at?
If you come out of the Rocky Mountains, as the range is called the Wasatch Mountains, from the east, and you look west, to the northwest, you see the vast and shimmering Great Salt Lake, which is a foreboding, inhospitable kind of a place. You have a broad valley that at that time was essentially treeless. There was a river of a modest size running through the middle of that, and very, very little to recommend itself. No timber in the valley. The timber was all in the surrounding mountains and canyons.
It's not sounding very promising.
No, not at all, not at all. And that was deliberate because the notion was we've got to go where nobody else will want to compete with us or drive us out.
What about local Indian people?
There were Native American people there, but they were nomadic. They'd move through the valley. They move along. In the valley just to the south called Utah Valley, where there's a large freshwater lake, there was a much larger Native American presence. Mm-hmm. But the initial relations were quite hospitable as they began. Let me just digress and say that another company of Latter-day Saints decided to make the journey from the east coast of the U.S. by ship, and they went down the Atlantic and around South America and up to the Sandwich Islands or Hawaii and then to San Francisco. And they were, that may be an easier trip. That's hard to imagine. Their leader, Sam Brannan, crossed the desert of Nevada from California, the Sierra Nevada, and actually encountered Brigham Young and his westward group before they reached the Salt Lake Valley. So he'd already been through the Salt Lake Valley, and he practically begged and pleaded, said, "Don't stop there. There's nothing there. Come to California. It's green. There's the chance to prosper." And Brigham Young was adamant, "No, that is not our plan, or that's not God's plan for our people. We will go to the desert."
So it was a visionary decision.
Yes, truly it was. He regarded it as such, and Latter-day Saints, as we commemorate that, with such, you know, enthusiasm and such remembrance, regarded as such.
Brigham Young himself, shortly after, I think, 1849, established what was called the Perpetual Emigration Fund, and that was a fund to assist poor Latter-day Saint immigrants, the people who couldn't afford to get there.
Yes.
But this brings me to a point that I'm very interested in to ask you, particularly as a leader of the church here. This notion of Zion, why did everybody want to gather in one place? Because it seems to me this word Zion comes up all the time in Latter-day Saint teaching, and it has something to do with what's going on here at Salt Lake City, doesn't it?
Well, it does. The Latter-day Saint cherished definition of Zion, and of course, in the Bible, you find it having reference to geographical places, as it does. But the concept of Zion, it's more of an idea. It's not a place, it's an idea, and the idea is where the pure in heart dwell. And so this was the great aspiration of these people who laid it all on the line and struck out for the unknown because their desire was to try to purify their own hearts and live with like-minded people who were endeavoring to do the same and to worship God as they understood God to be worshiped. And so they were driven by that vision, that concept, that dream of their Zion.
So it's an ideal place. It's an ideal society. Because I do recall in reading that Kirtland, Ohio had been referred to as Zion at one point.
Yep.
Jackson County, Missouri had been. In Nauvoo, Illinois had.
Yep.
And then Salt Lake City. So it isn't a physical location. It's about an ideal society almost.
Yes, exactly. You understand that very well, Noel. And so in a worldwide church today that does span the globe, we conceptualize Zion as where people are endeavoring to be pure in heart and to establish the church. At that period of time, in the early formative years of the church, looking back, I think historians might say, you know, it never would have managed to flourish but for the gathering, because in its infancy, it needed the strength of the numbers, the people who were in tiny congregations around the globe, for them to come together and build that nucleus in order to be strong enough to then go out and carry that message and that concept of Zion to the rest of the world.
Well, this was part of the first stage of the great formation of the church, though, wasn't it? Because I was surprised to read that Danish Latter-day Saints were arriving by the 1850s, British Latter-day Saints, because Mormon missionaries had made off around the world already, they were all gathering into Zion, which for that time meant Salt Lake City. That was a period of growth in the church, of consolidation, as it were.
Yes, it was enormous. When you speak of the Perpetual Emigration Fund, that was largely to benefit the European immigrants who gave all they had to cross the Atlantic. And so the concept of the Perpetual Emigration Fund is that they raised money among the Latter-day Saints, wherever they were, who could contribute to it, and those funds were used to fund the transport of their fellow saints, and then they incurred an obligation. It's a pay-it-forward fund is what it amounts to, so that you can bless your brother who follows you.
This whole thing, though, that the gathering to Zion has changed, though, hasn't it? In 2013, there has been a shift in Latter-day Saint teaching because I think, what, do we have five temples now in Australia? And I think there is a sense that Zion can be in lots of places. It's extended even further now.
Exactly, and that shift in thinking has happened decades ago. And indeed, you mentioned five temples in Australia. There are more than 140 around the world. So the conceptualization with nigh into 14 million members of the church now, or 15 million members of the church, is to carry that Zion to the world. And wherever we have temples and congregations and people who are endeavoring to live that kind of a life of purity in heart, that is where we endeavor to establish Zion. So, yeah, no, people are no longer encouraged to pack up and move to Salt Lake City. That hasn't happened in a long, long, long time.
By way of a summation, I'd like to repeat to you a quote and also ask you a question about how this relates to people of other religions, because now that most Mormons live outside Utah, I want to ask you about relations with other religions. I was fortunate enough some years ago to meet President Gordon B. Hinckley when he was here in Australia.
Charming man, wouldn't you say?
A lovely man, truly, and his wife also, a lovely woman. And I do remember him speaking and quoting Brigham Young of what the Mormon people, the Latter-day Saints, were about as they spread across the world. And he quoted these words. He said, "To be adverse to Gentiles because they're Gentiles, or Jews because they're Jews, is in direct opposition to the genius of our religion. It matters not what a man's creed is, whether it be Catholic or Episcopalian, Presbyterian, Methodist, Baptist, Quaker, or Jew. He will receive kindness and friendship from us."
The other part of the Mormon migration, you have to realize, while the Latter-day Saints were still coming through for 20 years, the Great California Gold Rush began in 1849, and so people of all stripes were moving through Salt Lake City, and many stayed. And churches of other denominations, Jewish synagogues were built, and so the Mormons were not as isolated as they fancied themselves to be. And our great desire is to be the kind of a neighbor to anyone, whatever their religious persuasion or lack of religious persuasion. We're all children of the same God, and therefore we ought to treat each other like that. And so we have the greatest respect. One of the things that Gordon B. Hinckley, whom you mentioned, said frequently to people of other religious traditions, he said, "Bring what you have, all that is good, bring it and let us see if we can add to that." So it's not an adversarial kind of a relationship, even though we are certainly a missionary church.
Perth Mission President of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Bruce Lindsay, thank you very much for being part of the program.
Noel, it's a delight to talk to you. Thank you very much.